Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Ascot in October 2025. Our expert panel navigate the perfect storm of multiple trends hitting the industry all at once, from precision fermentation solutions to the uncomfortable thought that making people happy with food might soon require permission from their health insurer.
So without further ado, we're going to go down the panel. And all I ask is you say who you are, what you do, where you're from, and tell us, what do you think is the biggest trend and how do you think it's going to impact ingredient innovation or product development in your particular part of the industry or your particular area of function?
So apart from the director of the Bezos Center, I'm also a professor at Imperial College in engineering biology. So I've been doing research in the past 15 years in precision fermentation, now moving also to other type of fermentation like biomass fermentation. I run a research group of 40 people, PhD students and postdoc that are doing innovation in this space. Building new tools to make those processes and microorganisms better and producing those ingredients to increase in titers, yields, productivities, making more functional ingredients using those microbes. We do a lot of applied research. We really work a lot with industry, making those early stage innovation experimental projects that can be then taken by industry and commercialized, hopefully. The second question that was, what is the big trend? In my point of view, of course, I mentioned this already in my presentation before, is technology innovation. So engineering biology, I think, is a driver force that is help us create new ingredients, functional ingredients in a better way, in a way that we can make them more sustainable, but also select them to be more healthy. When we produce them. So it allows us to not only maybe make the ingredients we already have in a better way, but also be creative, bring with new ingredients that we can start considering for novel food applications. So I think engineering biology and also AI can play a big role on that matter.
Excellent. Thank you, Rodrigo.
Okay. Hi, my name's Abby Owens. I'm from Yeo Valley Organic, and I'm an innovation manager on the new categories as Yeo Valley begins its journey from a dairy to a food business. So we've just recently launched into meat and even more recently into cereals. So I've been working on those products and helping them the transition from yogurt into a much broader food business. The biggest trend I think I've seen affect our business is this trend in functional food claims. So you'll see stuff like immunity, mood, sleep on packaging, but also how we counteract that with the rise in UPF and clean label awareness within the consumer market and how we can achieve those claims whilst remaining still clean deck.
Excellent. Thank you, Abby.
Hi, my name is Diane Camp. I work at Sodexo. For those of you who don't know Sodexo, it's a global food service and facilities management organization, started in 1966. I only say that because next year we celebrate 60 years, which will be quite exciting. I joined Sodexo just under 3 years ago. I started at the UK and Ireland food platform, which basically looked after menu and recipe development across all segments with a focus on our priority brands, which is Kitchenworks and Modern Recipe. Recently, I've just moved across into more of a global role, which is still culinary based, but this time looking more at kind of trends and innovation and how we can translate that into our priority brands. For my trend, I see it's a bit of a follow-on from hot honey. I see there's a real big trend towards still mixing heat, but this time with caramel. So my trend's very much an ingredient-based trend.
Thanks, Diane.
My name is Tim Ingmeyer. I'm currently lead the global R&D innovation team at Plaidis Global. For those of you who don't know Plaidis Global, because it's not a name that most people know, we're the company that owns brands like Mefitis and Jacobs. In Turkey, in the Middle East, you may be familiar with a brand called Ulker, actually one of the largest brands in Turkey. And for those who like chocolate, we also own the Godiva brand. So you can imagine being in a company that does these things is just a chore. It's terrible. No, someone's got to do it. And we have a whole bunch of other brands as well, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Pilates, at the very heart of who we are, and this comes right back to the founder of the company that owns us, Allcare, so Yildiz Holdings. So we're a privately owned company, by the way. The owner of the company had a very simple philosophy, which is we're here to provide happiness, right? And that's been true for the last 100 years. And we say it's happiness with every bite. And I think for me, in terms of there isn't one single trend, because I think, you know, for any of you here in R&D, one of the things that we have to do to deliver is everything, everywhere, all at once, right? We are buffeted by multiple trends. But I think for me, if I think about happiness and how we define happiness and how that's evolved over the years, it used just to be, does it taste nice, right? That's still rule number one, number two, and number three, right? Taste, taste, taste. I think what's important though is how happiness has evolved. And whilst taste is the very foundation of what we do, it's then quickly followed by what we would call permissibility. What do we mean by permissibility? One, does the product have a nutritional profile that works for you, right? Obviously it has to work from a regulatory perspective. Does it work for you? If it doesn't, you're probably not going to pick up that product and eat it. Number two, and this is something that is becoming obviously much hotter, and you're I'm sure trying to make sense of this, is clean label. Clean label's been a trend since I've been working for many, many years, and it's now in its newest form of ultra processed foods. And these have been things we've been working on for quite a while. And then the third thing in the aspect of permissibility is sustainability, right? Historically, just the packaging, but more and more now, consumers are interested in the sustainability of the ingredients and the raw materials that have gone into those products. So clearly what we're having to do is wrangle with all of that to still make products that hit each of those permissible requirements, but still taste fantastic, and something that you will relax with when you have a cup of tea or coffee.
Excellent, thanks Tim. Sounds like you've got quite a long to-do list.
Always, always.
Well, I wanted to pick up on something that actually Abby and Tim, you both mentioned, and I think touches on maybe some of the issues that Rodrigo's area may face, is this kind of reaction to additives and ingredients that have been in foods for, you know, decades, if not longer, and, you know, are often added to benefit the consumer, vitamins, minerals, proteins, and a whole host of other kind of fortificants. You know, and if anyone's seen the adverts, I think it was on, I don't know if it's more than one episode, but on TV, you know, Joe Wicks and Chris Van Tulliken launching their killer sports nutrition bar. You know, there seems to be a real groundswell of public reaction. Well, I say public, loud voices in the public area, whether they are reflect kind of the vast majority of people or not, I think it remains to be seen. You know, how much of an issue do we see this rejection of ingredients being for the industry? And Rodrigo, for you, I suppose it's, you know, are you looking at this worried that this may be in a rejection of adoption of new technologies? So, you know, while some of the things you may ferment or produce are nature identical molecules, they're obviously produced in a very different way to how nature does it. So, you know, do you think that's a real concern for the adoption of precision fermented ingredients moving forward?
I think it's a concern for all type of ingredients, especially with the rising voice in ultra-processed food and so on. I think fermentation have a specific position on it, because we are very familiar with fermentation. We know it's been around. We know it's good for our gut. We like those products. I think general perception of fermented products is good or better than others, perhaps. We have vitamins made, amino acids made through precision fermentation for quite some decades already, and we're all familiar with that. And I don't expect that to change very drastically, hopefully, in the next few years. And I think the other thing that fermentation is very good at is perhaps providing taste and texture without the need for add ingredients. So if we go back to redefining traditional fermentation is basically taking products from plants or animals and converting something that tastes better, lasts longer, is safer, is good for us. And we can now start thinking of redefining that with new organisms, with new raw materials, and avoid the need for added ingredients if those ingredients are already made in the process. So there's a lot of innovation that can happen with fermentation, avoiding what is named as ultra-processed, but I think there's a lot of room for developing new ingredients as well. I think something that is very important is working with the consumer, working with the public, explaining what this is, how it's made, and I'm going to convince them that it's better for us and for the planet.
Excellent, thanks Rodrigo. And Abby, just to pick up on your point, I think there'll be quite a few people in the room agreeing that balancing how you meet the need states of consumers, so as you I think mentioned, things like immunity, gut health, often requires adding ingredients that could be accused of being ultra processed. And certainly some of the things being shown today probably would fulfill some of the criteria, obviously the different definitions of ultra processing, so it can be quite challenging in itself to understand what is ultra processed and what isn't ultra processed. How are Yeo Valley balancing that? So, immunity requires things like vitamin D being added, maybe zinc, that opens you up to accusations of being ultra processed. How do you weigh the benefits and the consequences of, possibly being categorized as a type of product that you wouldn't necessarily associate with Yeo Valley Organic?
But I think there's certain more natural ingredients that you can look to use within products, such as immunity, more citrus fruits, turmeric, honey, those sort of more natural ingredients that people may associate with immunity. So I think there's a lot of work to be done on how you can still make those claims, but I think using more natural ingredients is probably the way to go. And, when a consumer picks it up in the store, they turn it over and they recognize the ingredients. I think it's still a really important aspect. Telling them it's got zinc in it may not directly correlate with them to immunity. So I think leveraging those ingredients that people do associate with immunity is quite important. Chamomile or lavender, I think lavender is another huge trend that's coming up the roadmap. And I think utilizing those ingredients to convey a message on the packaging is really important. Like, make it simple for the consumer to understand what the purpose is of the product.
But do you think that we're going to see more and more consumers? There's lots of studies out there showing that most consumers don't look beyond that kind of front of pack. Certainly if it's a brand they recognise, a brand they trust, do you think we're going to start seeing more and more consumers actually turning it over and looking to see, what is actually in this product? Do you think that could be a challenge for the industry?
Yeah, definitely. I think in the past few years, more and more people start to turn over the packaging and really care about what they're putting in their body. I think this kind of also links in with the GLP-1 drugs and people craving more nutrient-dense foods and being more aware of what they're eating and how that can fuel their life and how it can add to their life. It's not just part of their day-to-day life. They want to know what it can do for them. So I think it will definitely become more popular.
Excellent, thanks Sabrina. And Tim, you mentioned clean labels, obviously not a new, UPF is arguably the latest iteration of the clean label trend that's been around for, the 10 years that you've been working, obviously. How do you see it evolving? I mean, a lot of what people like, Joe Wicks, more recently Chris Van Tulleken and many other people in the public eye are saying is not necessarily anything that the industry hasn't heard before, but do you think it's reaching a new height? Do you think it is a different dimension to the challenge the industry is facing?
You can see which way the current's flowing, right? Is the dynamic changing? It's becoming a little bit heater. I mean, there's always been antagonists looking at what's in different foods, and there's absolutely the right thing to do. I think the question is, what is the nature of the discourse, right? But so I'm not going to go into that. Well, others have done so, and others will continue to do so. If I just build on some of the comments that were just made earlier, though, I mean, we talked about taste and permissibility. What we're starting to look at now is, how do we start to create products with much more naturally wholesome ingredients, right? Actually, if you look at most of our products, they already are. But how do we push that even further? And then how do we use processing techniques, which are much more minimal, much more gentle, that overcomes some of the negatives of some of the raw materials that we're wanting to use. So for example, if you're using pulses, you've got a whole range of anti-nutritional factors. Well, how do you overcome those? You've got taste issues. How do you overcome those taste issues? And we are seeing an emergence, I think, of processing technologies which will unlock these ingredients in great tasting products. And I'm just going to give you an example, one, because you know Rodrigo's on the panel. And it is fermentation. Fermentation is being used in a number of ways that, you know, we even 10, 15 years ago, I think we would have thought was probably magic. But what I will say is there's also a renaissance in what I would call traditional fermentation. You said it exactly right. So how can we use traditional fermentations that's been a part of culinary heritage in countries probably outside of Europe, right? So we're not necessarily familiar with it, to help us transform pulses. So if I look in, for example, in the Far East in India, how fermentation is used traditionally in those cultures to create absolutely fantastic tasting products. So how can we use that for what we do? And the opportunities there are incredibly rich. So that's one trend around technology that we are particularly interested in, especially as it fits with who we are as bakers. Right, and then if you get that right, then you can tailor that according to the specific needs of your consumers, whether they're younger consumers, older consumers like me, you know, people who want sports benefits or whatever their particular needs are. I think one of the trends that I'm seeing, I think Mike, you and I have discussed this before. You know, food was very much biology, and then obviously as we in the post-war era, we moved from just biology to physics and mechanics. So that's when all these processing industries kind of took off. And then once we made all the investments in plant in our factories, and we still needed to drive yield and throughput and still drive shelf life and nutrition for a growing population, then we started to move to chemistry. And one of the bigger trends I'm seeing is a step back from just focusing on chemistry to coming back to biology. And I think as a biologist, I think we have barely tapped the potential in biology to create fantastic tasting, nutritious, sustainable food.
Excellent. Thanks, Tim. Dan, food service has quite a different, you know, food service manufacturers have quite a different relationship with their clients than some of the branded manufacturers. So Abby and Tim, in that how you communicate what's in foods is quite different to your consumers. And in the case of some of Sodexo's clients that you mentioned, like schools and prisons, they don't necessarily have much choice about what they're eating. How do you, you know, work out how what is best to communicate to your clients and how, you know, to enable them to make informed decisions about what they're eating?
I was just going to say, I think from a supply point of view, the whole ultra-processed journey is quite a challenging one, and I'm kind of glad I don't have to go on that journey. But it is really interesting, and it is unfortunate that sort of ultra-processed foods, there is such a debate, and we still don't know the answer, and it's kind of interesting to be part of the journey to see where we end up with kind of ultra-processed foods. And exactly that, our kind of clientele and audience is slightly different. So I think what we sort of focus on, and it's like what everyone's mentioned here, is we need to focus on how is it good for the consumer? What benefit can they get? And then you take them on the journey that way. So we have obviously good relationships with our suppliers. So we're ensuring that we're buying in the best products, but our consumers don't really care about that. All they want to know is that meal that I'm going to go and choose, how healthy is it for me? How much fiber am I going to get in it? And they also want us as a business to deal with all the sustainability side and things like that. So it's, I guess the way we do that is through, I mean, it's really kind of common table talkers and LTOs and pop-ups and things like that. So we do try and engage and talk to our consumers on a regular basis. And I guess that's all we can do. And we'll train our chefs to know about the food that they're serving to then be able to communicate to our customers what they need to.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? So I think it's, thinking about reaching schools, how I mean, I imagine you can create trends, right? If people like what they're eating, it's a great way to introduce new food that might be healthier, more sustainable. How do you go about those choices and how do you select things and work in that education of the consumers that maybe can take this to their homes and choices as well?
I think schools is quite an interesting one. It's because it's a good opportunity to train the children because that's your kind of key. So we'll do a lot of pop-ups. We'll do lots of, hey, try this fruit or this vegetable. It's really interesting. And then go home and tell your parents about it because that is where a lot of it falls down is that parents don't often cook good healthy meals. So that's an opportunity for us to prepare those meals on site and then educate the children. And through the children, we can then educate the parents. So I don't think you really follow trends as much, but it's more of an education piece and a bit more of that healthy eating and how food can sustain you for longer during the day.
And as a business,
go.
How do you balance that? You obviously want to be as profitable as possible, but you want to educate and the next generations. How do you, where do you make that balance? Maybe having a product that might not be the cheapest, but it's maybe the best.
That is one of the biggest challenges we face because obviously we're constrained by sort of our cost parameters as well. So I think it's very much about educating and doing pop-ups and talking to the children. We are very kind of restricted in the sort of menus that we have to do and produce. So it is hard and the guys do a great job. I don't know much about the education side of it, but they definitely are doing a lot to promote healthy eating.
Thank you. I'm doing my job, Rodrigo. That's correct. So one trend that I think is definitely going to be on people's minds. We've heard some of the partners for the event today mention it already, and it's certainly there's a lot of unknowns. So please do gaze into your crystal balls when I ask you this question, because I'll be very impressed if you know the answers. But it'd be great to understand where your thought process is and what you think is going to happen, and that's GLP-1, which is, in some ways a potential existential threat to the food industry as we know it, and we're already seeing, some of the ripples in the industry, certainly in the US, where consumption of GLP-1 is a much higher level than it is in Europe, where, basket size is shrinking, spend is shrinking, and some sectors are certainly being affected more than others. So, to the panel, please jump in if you've got something you'd like to say on this. Is GLP-1 a threat or is it an opportunity? And if so, why?
It's both. In every threat, there's an opportunity, right? And never waste a crisis. So, look, I assume we're all up to date on GLP-1, what it is and kind of what it does. I think one of the ones that the impacts that it has for me, which is quite interesting, is what it does to your sense of reward, right? And the people who are on GLP-1 drugs just don't get the same sense of pleasure from eating and drinking. So it doesn't just affect, obviously, the food industry, it also affects, the alcoholic drinks industry as well. I think there's three opportunities, right? I think there's an opportunity for what are the food products for those who are on GLP-1 drugs? Right. What are the opportunities for those who have come off GLP-1 drugs and want to maintain their healthy habits as much as they possibly can? And then what about those who actually don't want to use medication at all? there's an opportunity there as well. I think it's still very early days. The doomsayers are, yes, it's going to be an existential threat. It has the potential to be the most transformational trend that we've seen in the food industry. Because if you assume that, 60% of the population in the UK is overweight, a large part of that is obese, and the NHS want to potentially prescribe it to those individuals, and those who don't get prescribed can still access it through other means, whether they're obese, overweight, or not, they just want to use it as a lifestyle. You can see how that could be a doomsday scenario for the food industry. I think it'll be much more measured than that, right? The reality is always much more measured than the doomsayers say. I think there's an awful lot of people who are making a lot of money out of saying it's a doomsday scenario. Oh my God, you know, the world is going to fall, you know, the sky's falling down, and come to me and I will solve your problems, but you've got to pay me a lot of money. Right? There's a lot of that going on. I think if for those who read New Nutrition Business, and Julian Medicine always takes a much more balanced view, I think I would advise doing that. But there is still an opportunity for those who, you know, who are activated by this. How we are doing that, what does that mean? We're still figuring out. We're still trying to understand what are the raw materials and ingredients that we can use that have some GLP-1-like effect. You know, we ran an accelerator recently, and one of the startups that we shortlisted was a startup called Pulson. And again, they've got some minimally processed pulse flours, where they say they have clinical evidence to suggest that it does stimulate GLP-1 agonist production, right? So we will see more of this. And I think for those who really want to get into it, there will be an opportunity. I don't think it'll be as big as opportunities maybe we think, but it'll be more than niche. So somewhere between those extremes, I think, is the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't have a crystal ball to tell you.
Great insight, Tim. Thanks. I mean, for those of you thinking it's maybe not going to be that widespread usage, because obviously the prices have gone up with the trade deal that we're doing with the US at the moment, some of the first generation GLP-1 drugs lose their patents next year. So we will be seeing much lower cost versions hitting the market probably late 2022. I mean, I imagine they're already ready to go in the factories that make these generic versions. So yeah, expect much more widespread usage and much lower prices imminently for the GLP-1 agonist. So I would expect a much wider adoption because the bar is pretty low. I mean, Tim talked about the amount of population that is eligible for them. Your BMI doesn't have to be that high for you to meet the NHS guidelines. It's just if you want the NHS to pay for it, your BMI has to be quite high. But if you're willing to pay for it, the bar really isn't very high to get it. So I think, you know, there's no...
Because I think what we're also seeing is not just the NHS. You know, private health insurance companies are also paying for it, parts of the world, because the overall risk of somebody who's significantly lost weight, the overall risk to the insurance company is much, much lower, right? And so for them, it absolutely pays to medicate. That for me is one trend that's symptomatic of something which is coming at all of us, right? Which is the role of other stakeholders in driving our diets. Let me give you an example of that, right? And it comes again back to the insurance companies. How many of you have learned to drive recently? Or I've got kids that have learned to drive recently. I have. I haven't just learned to drive. I've got kids that's just learned to drive. You get a reduction on your premiums if you have a little black box which tracks everything you do, right? And if you drive nice and safe, your premiums will be reduced. And we've done a piece of foresighting work to look at, well, where could that take you? How many of you have an Apple Watch? Or an Aura ring? How many of you have some tech that tracks what you do and the state of your health? All right. Now imagine one day in the future there's going to be a sensor developed which won't need you to wear a continuous glucose monitor. It will measure a whole additional range of biologics readings. That sensor will be able to detect what happens in your body after you've eaten something. Who's reading that data? The insurance companies will be looking at technologies that allows them to find ways to reduce their risk by understanding how you're living your life by accessing your data. And if you eat healthily, they will reduce your premiums. All right. This kind of tracking also already happens in parts of the world. I heard a fantastic story. This is a classic early signal of somebody who was buying a product in, I'm not going to say the country, a country, and they were prevented from doing so because when the cashier scanned the product, they were told, sorry, sir, I can't serve you this. You have diabetes. Right? So what that means is that there will be ways and means by which your diet will be influenced by a whole new range of stakeholders. you are already probably buying into smart fridges, right? You're buying into this tech. So the way that tech will develop and the way that AI will develop will help you make the choices that you want that meet your lifestyle. And I don't think we've truly begun to understand that yet. But you can see all the things are in place right now to make that happen. So if you're here representing a company that makes food and a consumer can eat the product that you make and they can see the impact on a whole range of different aspects of their body, they can see that. Do you need to know that? Quite possibly you do. So I think that's a really interesting trend as to one thing that we're seeing as we look further into the future and then dialing back, and those things are already happening.
Fascinating and slightly scary insights there, Tim. Thank you.
I think the other side of it is it's empowering, right? So you will be able to access the ways and means by which you can live a healthier lifestyle.
As a consumer, I think it is incredibly empowering. Yeah. I think the concerns are the privacy of that, the ownership of that data, and who gets to read it. As you say, yeah, insurance companies don't always have individuals' best interests at heart. And, you know, other parties, again, who maybe don't have your best interests at heart and maybe want to use that data for nefarious means, I think it would be the concern. But as a consumer...
Oh, that is a doomsday view.
yeah, obviously, I'm a glass half empty kind of guy, what can I say? I mean, I think as an individual, as a consumer, and being able to tailor your diet to a way that your body accepts it and performs at its absolute peak, I think is an incredible kind of future. As a food manufacturer, depending on your portfolio of foods, that is terrifying. You know, I mean, yourself, as you said, Pladis is there to, provide joy to their consumers. That again must provide a fairly existential threat.
No, because I think people always want to have a moment of joy, a moment of happiness, a moment where they just kind of disconnect. I mean, that's ultimately what the definition of indulgence is, right? Yeah. It's the moment where you allow yourself to do something you don't normally allow yourself to do, right? And I think, you know, we as humans will always want that. There will always be a role for that. Does that mean, though, that we shouldn't be evolving what we mean? Like I said, you know, permissibility has evolved. It will continue to evolve. But underneath all that is taste and texture and experience, right? So what is the nature of experience in the world where that's true? I think we're finding out, and I think it's quite an exciting journey because that's where innovation lies.
True, but I think, you know, take one of one of my favorite Pladis brands as an example, Jaffa Cakes. You know, is the volume of Jaffa Cakes sold to the people that have a Jaffa Cake on a Sunday night as a weekly treat, or is your volume the kind of people, of which I have been one in the past, who once that packet of Jaffa Cakes is open, you ain't stopping eating them until they're all gone?
It'll be all the above, right? It's a distribution, right? Will that mean that we don't evolve our core products? No, it doesn't. But, you know, I think, again, it's about having the right portfolio, which meets a range of needs for consumers, everything from being highly functional to being just highly enjoyable and indulgent, right? And the question is, how do we step into that? How do we evolve our portfolios for all of us based on some of these changes that we can see coming down the line? Yeah.
Which I suppose, Abby, Yo Valley's, that seems to be what you're doing. You're broadening your portfolio. I mean, when we spoke earlier in the week, I said there's probably people in the room that may not know Yo Valley sells meat. You know, very famous for your dairy. I've seen your cereals actually in the supermarket very recently. Is that part of the Yo Valley's journey to, you know, almost de-risk by, rather than being focused in on one particular category, broadening your portfolio so you're able to touch on these different consumers like Tim says?
Yeah, definitely. I think there is obviously ambition to grow the business more than just dairy, but I think still rooted in the farming principles that we have. And obviously Yo Valley is a multi-brand business now with the acquisition of The Collective. We have Tide Food, which is another soup brand, so there's always a food element to it, but I think it's just capitalising on that and making it bigger, but also giving consumers an option for an organic trusted brand, I think is really important. I think there's obviously lots of great organic brands out there, but I think there's not many that are across huge amounts of categories. So I think that was the main reason, I think, to give something to a consumer that they can trust in.
Excellent. I don't want to keep on the threats to the industry, but as I say, I'm a glass half empty kind of guy today. We've heard sustainability mentioned a couple of times, and certainly there's huge challenges. You know, single-use plastic has, you know, that the cost of that has recently come in, and that law's been signed off, which I think, you know, is technically being paid by retailers, but retailers tend to be quite good at making sure that their supply chain's picking up some of those costs. But I want to focus on sustainability of supply chains from a slightly different definition of the word sustainability, and that's the ability to keep making your products because your ingredient is available. And I think, Rodrigo, you know, some of the areas that you're working in is very much in that of, you know, in 20, 30, 40 years, we may not be able to keep making the volume of protein that we are at the moment, and you're looking to build that those technologies that allow a more sustainable kind of future of delivering protein to the growing population in a way that isn't necessarily destroying the environment. But I don't want to keep coming back to you, Tim, but you know, chocolate is certainly, I think anyone using chocolate as an ingredient or making chocolate will be aware of, it's not been a great couple of years for the global chocolate supply chain. You know, what does the future of chocolate look like for you if we're continuing to see poor harvests in the equatorial regions where, you know, all of the world's chocolate comes from? Do you see a future where chocolate doesn't actually contain any cacao?
It's been bumpy. It will probably continue to be bumpy. And look, that what we're seeing on cocoa is a symptom of what we're going to see more broadly, right? So for those who don't know, cocoa supply has been challenged. Most of the cocoa, 60-70% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa, and they've had challenges with their crop over the last few years, which means that you know, the cost of cocoa has increased significantly, which is why the cost of your favorite chocolate bar has increased significantly over the last couple of years. What does that mean for the future? We have to be prepared for a future where that bumpiness continues, right? And you would have all seen, I'm sure, startups that are looking to make cocoa alternatives without using, you know, without using cocoa. And they're using a range of different technologies. I think what's really neat about that is that a lot of them are finding ways to access scale waste streams, right? So we're seeing a lot of people go into press cakes of different types and ferment that. Again, fermentation comes up here as well, to create actually really good tasting alternatives to chocolate. Is there a place for that? Absolutely, I think there is. Will it overtake everything? No, I don't think it will. So again, it's a portfolio play. Where would you use that if you can actually crack that and get the product quality you want? And they're very, very close. So that's one route. We also see others, and again, Rodrigo mentioned this, right? Precision fermentation and biomass fermentation. So how do you grow cocoa not in a plantation, but in a fermenter? The fundamental technology works, right? Plant-based cell cultivation is not new. The question is, how do you do it for cocoa cells to the standard that we expect from regular cocoa at a price we would expect from regular cocoa? Are they there yet? No. Do they have a line of sight? A lot of these companies, yes, they do. Would I be hopeful that they could crack it? Yes, but the price still remains a significant challenge. So I think what we see is a range of technologies being developed that will help mitigate any future significant bumps in cocoa supply. The other side of it, of course, is that we need to see, I think, increased focused investment in the fields, in the plantations, in the varieties, in the ways that we are growing cocoa, in the ways that we're then fermenting, and in the ways we are rewarding farmers, right? That all of that can be solved. It should be solved. Because if we can solve that and create much broader supply of cocoa than where it currently is, at greater yields, with greater resilience, with better reward for the farmers, we may not need these alternative technologies, but we need them at the moment because that's part of a mitigation plan. And I think that's, again, symptomatic of what we need to look at for actually a lot of our other commodities. right? Technologies are out there, the startups are are really working on this. There's some cool stuff going on. If you haven't looked at the startups and what they're doing in food tech, it's really, really exciting, right? So it's an absolute classic. Demand and necessity breeds great innovation. And I think that's what we're seeing. And companies like us and companies, teams like mine, have to stay abreast of that and start looking at how we incorporate some of this stuff. Because it's going to take years to develop the final products that we'd be happy with at a scale and price that you'd be happy with. And it will take time for these startups to develop that. So by the time, hopefully, we have the need, we'll have the solution.
Excellent. Thanks, Tim. And Diane, from a flavour perspective, I've certainly seen walking around the supermarkets, a lot of the MPD that's coming, rather scarily, a lot of the Christmas products already in the supermarket shelves. Huge proliferation of white chocolate, obviously, given the cacao supply chain challenges. From a kind of executive chef, I imagine a lot of what you do is menu design, new products, right at the first stage is generating those ideas that can then be scaled up. Do you have a kind of ready-made supply of alternative ingredients for some of these high-risk things, or do you just have to run into the kitchen and start whipping up some new products when your supply chain buyers tell you that they can't get hold of something?
The second one. But it's really interesting because I was actually going to ask Tim about what he thought about going down the route of blended. I think there's a lot of possibility to go down the route of blended. Like you said, there's a need or an opportunity for your alternative chocolates to come through. And this isn't just for chocolates. This could be for anything. It's been really interesting because I actually produced a blended burger with partnership with Korn for our UK market. And we launched it, but we were almost too early ahead of our time. And we just couldn't get all the proper stakeholder buy-ins, which was a real shame because I went to North Scotland to give a blended burger to the manufacturing side of the business. And of course, they told me exactly what to do with the burger. So it was quite fun. But a year later, we went back to Scotland and it wasn't as negative as it was a year ago. So it was really interesting to understand that through social media, through talking about it, through learning more and more what the opportunities are, that there is going to be a potential shortage and how we can come to some sort of a solution. And I think blended is definitely kind of that stepping stone to the next step, because another kind of interesting point is I think our taste profiles will change over the years. So as we start moving into more of a blended approach, we'll become more used to that profile. So therefore, going into your alternative proteins or chocolates, your taste profiles will go on that journey as well. So I thought that was quite an interesting point. I don't know if you want to, or Abby, if you want to add anything to.
Well, I was going to ask Abby about, blended is a great opportunity. There are health benefits. Certainly if you look at meat, of adding in things like beans or lentils or corn, much higher fiber content. We've already heard from Rodrigo this morning that we're not eating enough fiber. So there's a huge opportunity there. But do you not think there's a danger of the consumer perception being that the manufacturer is trying to make the product cheaper without necessarily passing those costs on to the consumer? The given the cost of living crisis in the UK and inflation levels that we've seen, where in food has been generally significantly higher than the kind of the published rate of inflation and some of the other measures that are used to measure it. So, the food industry is getting a lot of flack from people that are struggling to afford things. Do you not think there's a potential negative connotation of using blended approach where people think, oh, they're just trying to take out expensive ingredients and sell us lentils and beans as opposed to meat?
I mean, I know that Yo Valley, we have started to explore blended mince options, so with pulses, and I think a few retails have done it in the past few years and they've often got delisted fairly quickly because they haven't generally been picked up. And I think it's because if you're buying meat, you just want it to be meat. Like, you're probably already admitting that you're paying a bit more, and you can bulk it out with other stuff yourself. So I don't think, you know, the compromise potentially on shelf life as well, when you add those extra ingredients in, it's not worth it for the consumer. And I just don't think as a population we're quite there yet to embrace that sort of hybrid product. I think people like to pick and choose when they eat meat and when they don't. I think if they're eating meat, they want it just to be plain meat. And then if they're having vegetarian meal, then they'll just make it themselves with pulses. So I think there has been a bit of a decline in those alternative vegan proteins. And I think that's also the shift towards more whole food ingredients, people making their own at home with tinned beans, pulses, veg. And I think that's just the general awareness in the population, like people are becoming more educated on what they put in their body. Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks, Abby.
Can I just add something?
Please do.
So when I did my blended burger, it was a 60-40 ratio split. So 40% corn mince and 60% Angus beef. So it was a good quality beef. And lessons learned was that my percentage was too high. I went in too bold. I thought, oh, yes, I'm going to make a huge statement and I'm going to do all the carbon saving, because that was the angle we were going for. It was a carbon saving burger. So I think if you're looking at a blended, it's the percentage that you will blend stuff with. So I almost feel like 25-30% seems to be the sweet spot for the blend. And I was at an exhibition the other day, and I was talking to a company, and they've created a blended burger for breaks, and their sweet spot was, it was a 30% mushroom fable and a 70% beef. So it does definitely feel like, exactly like you said, consumers are thinking that you're cheating them. But if you do that real, it doesn't alter the flavor as much as when you start encroaching onto that 40, 50, 60%. So I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I think we're touching on a couple of other things here. One is the role of emotion. And if you think about starting with a burger, you know, and what people read into a burger and the experience they want from a burger and emotion, what it means to them, you probably picked a really high bar. Had you started with a sausage, right, you may have got a much easier ride. And I think with all of these things, when you're looking at an alternative, how many of you have been to see Cirque du Soleil? Anybody in here? Was it enjoyable? Did you pay a lot more? I mean, it's quite expensive, right? Did you complain that there were no animals? Right, it's a circus. So it's about the experience that you're providing, I think, right? What is the emotion? What is the experience that you're providing? And how do you reframe that experience? So when we're looking at the future of cocoa, it isn't just about a chocolate tablet. A lot of you probably would have seen the whole craze around Dubai chocolate. In Dubai chocolate, there actually isn't that much chocolate, but it is an absolutely awesome product, right? Highly indulgent. You wouldn't say, oh my God, you know, but you've got pistachios and you've got a whole bunch of other stuff in here. Where's all the chocolate, right? So how do we talk about experience in a way that is, you know, elevates what, you know, the way the consumer is interacting with the product, what the consumer experiences and expects from the product, so they still have that emotional engagement. They get emotion what they want and potentially even exceeds what they're looking for. So yeah, if we just say, hey, look, we're going to replace a major part of this product and it's going to be exactly the same for you, I don't think that always works. Well, we know it doesn't always work, right? So how do you reframe that conversation and look at the whole experience that we're trying to provide to a consumer beyond just the product itself? Then I think you'll find ways through.
Excellent. Thanks, Tim. I think, yeah, we've seen that a little bit with HFSS reformulations where it's not possible. So rather than reformulate, you do MPD that fits the brief and delivers quite a different proposition, but allows the consumer to not have that emotional attachment like they do with an existing product on the market. Okay, so we're coming up to the end of our time here with our panel. So we do have a roving mic somewhere. So if anyone has got any questions for anyone on the panel, please do stick your hand in the air, and I'm sure they will be more than happy. Whether it's an individual or whether it's a question you would like to ask the whole panel, please do, and we'd love to hear from you.
Hello. It was a general question. I've absolutely loved the conversation. So I'm thinking about the blended product, and I'm thinking about it more so probably from the kind of the meat angle than the sort of sweeten chocolate sort of angle. But what is the difference, in your opinion, with how consumers would receive something when it is a burger or a sausage versus a ready meal? Because I'm thinking there are products that are, in essence, a blended product in the first place. What makes somebody less likely to accept that in a burger or a sausage than in a ready meal or a quiche or, you know, something that already has that great mix that they're already enjoying?
That's a really good question, and I have an opinion, but I'm more than happy, I think, for the panel. Diane, do you want to jump in on that?
So it was, again, lots of lessons learned, and I always thought, a burger, it's all the toppings and the fillings that you put with a burger, so it doesn't matter. But it so does, and I think the difference with the ready meals, or in hindsight, my crystal ball was broken at the time. If I'd gone back and done a meatball or a kofta that you serve with a sauce, you're almost experiencing the sauce more than you're experiencing the blended meat. Whereas with a burger, people are adding toppings onto it, but you're still tasting the meatiness of the burger. So I think the opportunity is definitely in a more of a ready meal or something you can add a sauce to, definitely helps with that kind of journey.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, from a technical perspective, a product that contains mince is potentially going to be easier to incorporate something into a blend. So a lasagna, say, is potentially much easier to incorporate plant protein into a plant-based substitutes. But also it's that, to Tim's point, it's that visceral kind of reaction that people have. So if you have a roast dinner ready meal, you know, that's certainly in the British mind, they have a very particular feeling about what they're expecting. You know, so even if it's something entirely new, maybe a cuisine from a part of the world that is less familiar to the British palate, there's a huge opportunity there to add things in. You may get, you know, castigated for it not being authentic. But again, if people aren't used to it or don't have an expectation, there's potentially a bigger opportunity there than, you know, as Tim said, a burger is such a, you know, people know what they want from a burger. It's not necessarily something healthy. I don't know. Any other?
The other thing that I found out was it depends what you blend it with. So when I was speaking to Fable, is a company that started in Australia, and they use all the offcuts of porcini mushrooms. And actually, they did a lot of research, and they found out that adding that in their title was a porcini and beef burger, it suddenly became premium and therefore was more acceptable. So it definitely depends what you blend your existing protein with.
Thanks, Dan. Oh, one more question. The mic is on its way.
I'm probably loud enough. probably one more for Tim and Abby.
Thank you. Look, I agree we're at the cusp of a pivotal moment in the food industry. The rise of GLP-1 mimickers, reduced UPFs, the demand for nutrient-dense food and a return to whole foods, it's all interlinked. But my main question is, how can we address the sheer level of social media disinformation out there, and how do we increase accountability in retailers? Actually, because we have to sell food at the end of the day, and we have to sell the right food to meet these demands.
It's a really good question, and I don't think there's a simple answer, right? I've always taken the view, when it comes to basic food education, brands can't do that. Brands are not given permission by consumers to teach them about basic food. And I do wonder whether there is a role for supermarkets, because of the way you can interact with the consumers across so many. If I go into a supermarket, yes, I can see the food on the shelf, but I've got, you know, what's on the shelf. I then bombard with a whole bunch of materials and leaflets and magazines that the supermarket is providing. So the various mechanics that a supermarket can have to intervene and influence consumers is quite large. And that's before you get back into social media. So even just in store, I think you can do quite a lot. Are supermarkets doing enough, or are they sitting back kind of riding the wave and just kind of pointing, yeah, it's all those guys? I think there's probably a case could be made for that. There is no simple answer, right? And I don't know what actually the right answer is, because
can
it's
I
not
just add? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I would say from a brand's point of view, there is a lot more that brands can do to show up on shelf and make it easy for the consumer at the point of purchase. Like, we know a lot of decisions when you're buying stuff are impulsive. So I think, you know, clear labeling on front of pack is a big way to communicate with the consumer. It's the brand's opportunity to convey their message and what they stand for and what they want to do. So I think brands can do a lot as well. I agree that retail can do more, but I do think the brand holds a certain type of responsibility as well.
Can I just one quick thought, and maybe farther away from the consumer. I think we also need more science backing up many of these claims and really good definitions of what ultra processes and what it means for your health. So basic research needs to be done, more clinical studies on nutrition, and to back up all these claims, I think can help the community, the influencers, social media, to go back to those sources of trust to also use that as a power of conviction.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's a lot of voices in the industry in the UK. So the IFST, that's the Institute for Food Science and Technology, and the FDF, so the, you know, the, probably the big Food and Drink Federation, for more education in schools on food science. So there's a GCSE out there, but there's still no A level in food technology. So you know, please do support, you know, if you feel passionately about this. You know, we get asked a lot of questions from our members at Camden about, I've read this, is this true? And one of the biggest challenges in nutritional science is there's very few definitive answers. There's a lot of grey areas, and it's not very black and white. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in a newspaper headline or a meme or, you know, a throwaway sentence on social media. People want definitive answers. And unfortunately, when it comes to nutrition, there aren't that many around. You know, this may help. You know, you might have this effect. People don't want that. People want to know definitively, if I do this, I'm going to see that benefit. And that is very, very difficult to be categorical. So yeah, big challenge that over the next few years. Okay, so that is time for the panel. So please join me in thanking them for what has been a fascinating panel.